And thus we come down to the great age of modern biography, which Dr. Johnson opened with his Lives of the Poets, and Boswell with his immortal book. Perhaps some critics would deny Dr. Johnson any conspicuous place in the history of biography. He did not write formal lives, but rather critical studies of the artistic, the aesthetic, that is, careers of his subjects. Hastily turned off as introductions to a publisher's collected edition of the major British poets. Some of these 52 narratives run to 100 pages, some only to 3 or 4. But the best of them, the Lives of Pope, Dryden, Addison, and Cowley, for example, are superb biographical essays. Dr. Johnson had read much, had listened more, and possessed a superb memory. He could be courageously honest in telling the disagreeable truth about men whom he liked. And with some lapses, he was fairly honest also in restraining his prejudices when he dealt with men whom he detested. He had a genuine insight into the minds and characters of his subjects, and he had also the indispensable flair for revealing anecdotes and speeches. Here I may borrow one at second hand. Take, for example, the story he tells of Dean Swift. Once Swift was angrily stopped by a certain man who accused him of being the author of a certain lampoon. He caustically replied, "Mr. Bettesworth, I was in my youth acquainted with great lawyers who, knowing my disposition to satire, advised me that if any scoundrel or blockhead whom I had lampooned should ask, 'Are you the author of this paper?' I should tell him that I was not the author, and therefore I tell you, Mr. Bettesworth, that I am not the author of these lines." This was a marvelous answer. And see how furiously helpless it left Mr. Bettesworth. What's more, we can see that volumes would not tell us more about one side of Swift's character than that speech does. Now, it's indispensable for a biographer, first after prolonged study and reflection, to make up his mind what his hero's character was. Not merely that, but what it was at 20, 40, 60. When unmarried and married, before fame and after fame. Having done so, we must find ways of illustrating the important aspects of that character in the most effective fashion possible. It will help greatly if the hero is not too subtle. Walter Scott is easier to portray than George Meredith. It will help also if the character has plenty of peculiarities, gentle eccentricities, picturesque ways, what Macaulay called the anfractuosities of Dr. Johnson's character and intellect. But above all else, the biographer must have an eagle eye for what illustrates character. That eye is given to few men. It does not do to assert that your hero is generous. That means nothing. It does not do to illustrate that statement by saying that he lent money to friends, carried the baby when his wife was tired, and expressed sorrow for the starving Chinese. All that is commonplace. The illustration ought to be unforgettable in its perfection. Albert Bigelow Payne, for example, gives us an incident that lights up Mark Twain as if a locomotive headlight had been suddenly turned upon the man. He tells how in Washington once, when they were staying at the Willard Hotel, supposing that Clemens would like to go down to dinner with as little ostentation as possible, he took him by an elevator that entered the dining room directly and without stopping at the long corridor known as Peacock Alley. When they reached the dining room, however, Mark Twain inquired, "Isn't there another entrance to this place?" And hearing that there was, a very conspicuous one, he added, "Let's go back and try it over." So, says Mr. Payne, we went back up the elevator, walked to the other end of the hotel, and came down to the F Street entrance. There is a fine, stately flight of steps, a really royal stair, leading from this entrance down into Peacock Alley. To slowly descend that flight is an impressive thing to do. It is like descending the steps of a throne room, or to some royal landing place where Cleopatra's barge might lie. I confess that I was somewhat nervous as to the awfulness of the occasion, but I reflected that I was powerfully protected. So side by side, both in full dress, white ties, white silk waistcoats, and off we came down that regal flight. Of course, he was seized upon at once by a lot of feminine admirers, and the passage along the corridor was a perpetual gauntlet. I realize now that this gave the dramatic finish to his day and furnished him with the proper appetite for his dinner. A less observant biographer might not have noted this incident. A less perceptive man might have smiled over it and quickly forgotten it. But in Paine's hand, it illuminates Mark Twain's perpetual adolescence, helps to explain why his devoted wife, Olivia, always called him youth. It illuminates his delight in showing off, as nothing else could. Active, expansive, and richly picturesque personages spill these revealing incidents out of their lives as spendthrifts spill coins. The biographers need only scramble over the pavement for them. Ben Franklin did so. From the day he walked up Market Street eating a roll to the day when, a very aged man, he stood in the Constitutional Convention pointing at the sun emblazoned on Washington's chair and delivering his immortal little witticism upon it. At last, he knew that it was a rising and not a setting sun. Charles James Fox spilled these revealing incidents out of his life. Lincoln did so. But other men go through their lives without exploding a single incident which yields illumination. In such instances, character can only be revealed by their larger and more important acts, by their letters and papers, and by their recorded utterances. A man like Thaddeus Stevens, for example, or Henry D. Thoreau, or James McNeill Whistler, can be strikingly revealed by what he has said or written, rather than by what he has done. Mr. John Burroughs wrote once that not one man in 500 could make any observations upon nature that have any scientific value. You can similarly say that not one man in 500 knows how to read character, or once it is read, to select anecdotes and speeches to illustrate it. The anecdotes, speeches, or letters. Letters have to be used with care for various reasons. One reason is that we must take into account not only the writer of the letter, but the recipient. For otherwise, we'll hardly know whether it's written in an intimate or formal mood, a sympathetic or unsympathetic mood. In many instances, it's imperative that a biographer indicate clearly all the circumstances under which any letter was written. And one additional caveat may be entered. It is by no means impossible that the great body of a man's correspondence will actually belie his character. There are men whose personalities change when they pick up a pen. Henry Adams's personality changed when he began to write a letter. A great many of his letters are unquestionably vitiated by an element of insincerity, of poesy. They are false. The late Wilfred Ward wrote a very interesting life of his father entitled William George Ward and the Catholic Revival. And he tells us that the mass of the letters of his father not only failed to illustrate the personality of the man, but in general, they went contrary to all the authentic evidence upon him. The bulk of his letters give the very opposite impression of the man from that which was true. They would give the impression of a man who was very dull and very intolerant, when actually he was very witty and very broad-minded. You will ask, says the son, how this is possible. The explanation is not so difficult as might be expected. My father, with his pen in hand, became argumentative and dialectical, an argumentative and dialectical machine. He rarely wrote letters of any length except in the way of theological and philosophical argument. The greatest danger in using letters as biographical material is that they will give an inadequate view of the writer. The great danger in using impressions and anecdotes is that they will give a one-sided view. Some men are one-sided, but most men of importance are not, and we need only refer to any distinguished leader to see that even honest observers very often set down very misleading observations and stories about him. Take so conspicuous an example as Lincoln. He first loomed up as an important national figure, known to the country at large, in 1858, the year of the Lincoln-Douglas debates. And from that time, a large number of Eastern newspaper men, politicians, and literary figures began to set down their impressions of him. It's clear that the preponderant testimony of casual observers in the years 1858 to 62 was emphatically unfavorable. That's not true, of course, of his intimates in Springfield. I'm speaking now of the casual observers whose observations would eventually get into print. Henry Villard, the German American newspaper correspondent, who wrote one of the best accounts of the Lincoln-Douglas debate, saw him at close quarters in 1858 and thought very little of him. Lincoln offended Villard by telling stories that the latter thought vulgar. The two men took shelter once to avoid a shower. "Some people are thinking of me, talking of me for president," said Lincoln, and laughed. "Just think, a sucker like me, president of the United States." Charles Francis Adams saw Lincoln in the White House just after he had been inaugurated. It seemed to him that Lincoln totally failed to appreciate the magnitude of the crisis, that he brought to public affairs a deplorable levity, and that he was far from equal to the nation's needs. An impression which was precisely parallel with that formed at the same time by so acute an observer as William Tecumseh Sherman. W.H. Russell, a very observant correspondent of the London Times, perhaps the best reporter of the mid-century period, saw Lincoln repeatedly in 1861. And thought him obviously inferior to Jefferson Davis as a chief of state. Stanton, later Secretary of War, wrote of the painful imbecility of Lincoln's policy, and he told McClellan, according to fairly authentic evidence, that Lincoln was the original gorilla and that the explorer Du Chaillu need not have gone to Africa to investigate the animal. We might pile up a mass of evidence of this sort, and as we now know, it was utterly and preposterously erroneous. When I began to write my life of Grover Cleveland, I found the view widely prevalent that Cleveland had been a blunt, forcible, and courageous, but coarse-skinned, heavy-grained, and rather vulgar man. The view that Harry Thurston Peck summed up in a quoted characterization, as sensual as a mutton chop. Had he not been a habitué of Buffalo saloons? Was he not inordinately fond of the beer and good feeding that had made him grossly fat? Did he not often play poker all night? Had he not begotten an illegitimate son? The fact that Cleveland was a man of sensitive and refined feeling, deeply emotional, fond in early life of poetry, kind-hearted to a fault, intensely attached to friends, a great lover of children, and innately religious, actuated in general by the loftiest motives, escaped these superficial observers. Some men lend themselves to biographical caricature. Their image can be distorted by a hasty, superficial, or dishonest biographer, just as Charles Dickens distorted his images of character. G.K. Chesterton tells us that the people Dickens presents were real people whom he had studied carefully, but that he saw them with the eyes of a youth. That is, he concentrated on those peculiarities of Micawber, Squeers, Fagin, Mr. Dombey, Mrs. Mantalini, and so on, which would delight an adolescent. Walter Bagehot has a different explanation. He asserts that Dickens really saw to the bottom of a character, but delighted in exposing its quintessential elements in a way that made them represent a type, not an individual. Thus, Sam Weller is the quintessence of all smart Cockney servants. He is the Cockney youth raised to the nth power. At any rate, the result is a distortion, to a degree, of the individual. Dickens followed a method quite legitimate to the novelist, but quite improper for a careful biographer. Yet biography often has a Dickensian quality. A Dickensian character pervades Paxton Hibbins' brilliant book called Henry Ward Beecher, An American Portrait, a book which overemphasizes, to say the least, the Pecksniffian element in Beecher. It's such a book as Marwa's Life of Shelley. It presents a Dickensian oversimplification of the great poet. How easy it would be for a biographer who wished to present a Dickensian portrait to do so with Charles Sumner, a striking American figure who still awaits, but I think will not long await, a good biographer. A dishonest biographer might begin by emphasizing the decorous correctness of Sumner's upbringing, Harvard College, law study, travel abroad. Some sly touches would indicate that Sumner was a prig. Biographer would tell us of Carlyle's harsh dictum on Sumner, the most complete nothing of a man that ever crossed my threshold, not whatsoever in him but wind and vanity.